it. A walk of shame along the Thames, to ease her pain. She had been surprised at how many other people were out and about, along the shore of silver-streaming Thames. Although Spencer's nymphs, the daughters of the flood, were notable by their absence. Unless they were a university team of grunting female rowers, hammering their way through the brown water as if they were being chased by a river monster. What kind of woman got up at 6 in the morning to row, Bertie wondered. A better woman than her, she supposed. Spencer handed over to Wordsworth, who met her at Westminster Bridge, where, early on a morning late in May, London really was all bright and glittering in the smokeless air, if only for a little while. She was surprised, to put it mildly, when she looked over the bridge and saw a gilded, swan-necked barge being rowed towards her. As she watched the boat sweep smoothly beneath the bridge, Bertie wondered if perhaps she had time-travelled back to Tudor times. "Gloriana," a voice said. She hadn't noticed the man who had come to stand next to her. "It's the Queen's barge," he said, "for the flotilla. Rehearsing, I expect." Of course, she thought. The river pageant. London was en fête for the Diamond Jubilee. So many lovely words, Bertie thought. Gilded, Jubilee, flotilla, diamond, pageant, Gloriana. It was almost too much to bear. "I thought I'd step back in time for a moment," she said. "Would you like to?" he asked, sounding like someone who was inviting her to enter a time machine that he had handily parked around the corner. "Well," she said. "Transactional supply-based relationships and commoditization." Bertie worked in an advertising agency, and for reasons now already forgotten to her, was in Belgravia, where Angus was facilitating a hackathon. Yes, really. Angus's father was a QC, and his mother a hospital consultant, and the family, a brother and 2 sisters, had been brought up in Primrose Hill, where Angus had a pretty normal childhood. Bertie had immediately mistrusted him. Nobody had a normal childhood. He was in marketing, an innovator, which didn't seem like a proper job to Bertie. "I'm in library services," she said, because that was always a conversation killer. "On the website," he puzzled, "it says you're in community education." "Same thing," she said, "more or less." She could never remember what her cover story was. She would have made a dreadful spy. "Community library," she amended, and his eyes duly glazed over at this information, and he turned his attention to the twice-cooked baby chicken on his plate. Surely once was enough for the poor thing. "Bluejacking, roadblocking." Angus was currently wearing a black T-shirt with a picture of Nipper, the HMV dog, on it. Beneath Nipper, and she really wished she didn't know this, Angus's chest was waxed. Nipper himself was beneath the Lloyd's Insurance Building in Kingston-upon-Thames. Bertie hoped that she didn't end up buried beneath a building. Or worse, excavated and put on show, like all those poor Egyptian mummies or the people from Pompeii, immortalized in their helpless death throes. Grandpa Ted wanted a woodland burial. "An oak, if possible." "He'll get what we give him," Viola said. "It's not as if he's going to know, is it?" But what if he did? The fight over his corpse had already begun, and he wasn't even dead yet. Bertie loved her grandfather. Her grandfather loved Bertie. It was the simplest arrangement. Standout talkability. What on earth was she doing with her life? Could she just get up and leave? Hot linking. Viola was the last person she would ever tell about the men she dated. Bertie was 37. "And counting," as Viola always reminded her in that giddy girls' school manner she had sometimes. "Just jump right in. You don't want to miss out on motherhood." Bertie's friends who were married with children. All her friends, in fact. Bertie had spent what seemed like nearly every weekend for the last 5 years at either weddings or christenings. All seemed enthralled to their children, each one a version of the second coming. None of these children seemed particularly attractive to Bertie, and she worried that if she had a baby, she wouldn't like it. Viola came to mind. She hadn't loved them, or it certainly hadn't felt like it, and she definitely didn't like them, although she seemed to like no one.
"Liking doesn't really come into it,"
Grandpa Ted had told her when he was still capable of giving advice.
"You'll be besotted with your own."
Bertie wasn't sure that she wanted to be besotted by anyone, particularly someone small and helpless.
"Your grandmother was besotted with Viola," her grandfather said.
So it just went to show. Anything was possible. A long time ago now, before he left on his hegira, Sonny had got a girl pregnant. Viola had been aghast, and then when the girl had a termination, she was equally aghast.
"No pleasing some people," Sonny said.
Viola had started sending Bertie links to donor websites, sperm supermarkets where you could simply pick a gene packet off the shelf. Scandinavian, 71 kilos, 6 foot 1 inches, blonde hair, blue-green eyes, teacher, and pop it in your basket. "Danish is best, apparently," Viola advised. Of course, Viola was terrified that if she didn't have grandchildren, her genes would die, and nothing of her would be left. She would cease to exist. Poof! Viola was 60 now, always waiting for people to say, "Never," which they didn't.
"You may not think so now," Viola said to her, "but when you get to 50 and turn around and find it's too late for motherhood, you'll be devastated."
Why did her mother always have to be so unnecessarily melodramatic? Because no one would listen if she wasn't? Of course, no one was more surprised than Bertie when 2 years later she had twins, and, yes, besotted, after marrying a perfectly straightforward man, a doctor, yes, that man on Westminster Bridge, and becoming, well, happy. But that wasn't now. Now was Angus, pumping the air with evangelical fervour, as if he were at a prayer meeting, and exhorting them to consider Selsumers. Bertie tried to divert herself by thinking of rhymes for Nonsense Man. Japan, frying pan, catamaran, watering can. But in the end she had to pull out scraps from the rag bag of loveliness that she was forced to carry around these days to protect herself from the evil materialist universe. Was advertising the right profession for her?
"Where the bee sucks, there suck I."
She could just go. She had a meeting at 2, and it would take her forever to cross London. The creatives were presenting ideas to the client for a new toothpaste. Surely there was enough toothpaste in the world already. Did people really need so much choice that they could never get to the end of choosing? As if the world needed more of anything. Yes, it was official. She was in the wrong profession. If Bertie was a god, a favourite fantasy, she would be manufacturing things there was a shortage of. Bees, tigers, dormice, not flip-flops and phone covers and toothpaste. No, don't go down that road, she thought. The creation fantasy was so vast and wide that she could be lost in it forever.
Monetize. Materialism. The frost performs its secret ministry, unhelped by any wind. Always on consumers. Whose woods these are, I think I know. Staggered event related. Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough. Outcome specific media burst. As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. Brand relevant content, re-energize consumers' perceptions of the... On Wenlock Edge, the woods in trouble. By doing that, you can take it all the way to bright. There's a certain slant of light. Chi-squared automatic interaction detection.
What?
Dear God, when did language and meaning divorce each other and decide to go their separate ways?
Bertie's rag bag of loveliness was almost depleted for the day, and it wasn't even lunchtime.
Oh, how full of briars is this working day world.
Oh, I'm so sorry, she said, when the nervous man sitting next to her twitched.
Did I say that out loud? Yes.
She stood up rather abruptly and whispered,
"Sorry,"
to the twitchy man.
"I have to go. I just remembered I left my real self on the tube. She'll be wondering what's happened. She's lost without me."
Angus caught sight of her and frowned as if he was trying to remember who she was. She gave him a little wave, waggling her fingers in a way which she hoped looked ironic, but it seemed to confuse him even more. On the tube, on the Piccadilly line, although that was probably not relevant, there was no sign of her real self. But there was a copy of the Daily Mail that someone had left behind. It was folded open to a page with a headline that blared, "Could the universe collapse today? Physicists claim that risk is more likely than ever and may have already started." How on earth would you tell? It was a curious usage of the uppercase. Bertie would have put the emphasis on collapse. It was how Viola spoke.
"You'll be devastated."
Rummaging around at the bottom of her rag bag for some crumb, Bertie couldn't even find a bit of wild thyme blowing around in there. "Are you watching the Thames pageant with Grandpa Ted?"
"Yes, I'm in his room," her mother said. "It's rubbish, isn't it? And the poor Queen, she's almost as old as Grandpa Ted, and she's having to suffer all this." "She'll catch her death in all that rain," Viola said.
Was that what happened? Bertie wondered. Did you have to catch your death, like a runaway horse? And it took some people, like Grandpa Ted, a long time to get hold of it, but others managed to grab the reins straight away. Like the grandmother she had never known. Nimble-footed Nancy, jumping on the back of death, a bold rider, so quickly that she must have taken everyone by surprise. Death itself, perhaps.
"Anyway," Bertie said, "can you put me onto Grandpa Ted?"
"He won't understand you."
"Just put me on anyway." "Hello, Grandpa Ted. It's Bertie here."
On the day, of course, the gilded barge had been forsaken by the Queen for a more prosaic Thames cruiser, Gloriana having been deemed too small for all the hangers-on, the protection officers and ladies-in-waiting and lackeys, that were necessary when a queen took to the river. Bertie had intended to join the flocks of people on the banks of the Thames to be part of something bigger than herself, something that she would remember in the future, in the same way that you knew where you had been at midnight on the millennium, drunk, in Soho House, something she regretted now, obviously. It had rained, however, relentlessly for the whole day, and Bertie had watched the admirable perseverance of monarchy on the television, the medium through which she had also experienced Diana's funeral, the Twin Towers falling, and the last royal wedding. One day, she thought, she would actually be somewhere when something happened, and it wouldn't be rendered second-hand through a lens, even if it was a dreadful spectacle, a bomb, a tsunami, a war. She would at least know the grandeur of horror. Grandpa Ted's brother, Jimmy, dead before Bertie could meet him, had been one of the first to go into Belsen. And then after the war, he left for Madison Avenue and joined one of the original ad agencies as a copywriter. To have lived a life of such polarities made her envious. Nowadays, you just did a degree in media studies. And Grandpa Ted himself, of course. Mind and body crumbling a little more every day, like a magnificent, neglected ruin, had once been a bomber pilot, flying into the jaws of death every night. The jaws of death. Is that a terrible cliché? She asked him on their farewell tour. An elegiac revisiting of his old haunts over 10 years ago now.
Why doesn't he just die? Viola wailed. How long does it take to say goodbye?
It had given Bertie an insight into her grandfather's life, into history itself, which, although gratifying, had also left her existential nerves jangled and confused.
"Promise me you'll make the most of your life," he had said to Bertie.
Had she? Hardly. She muted the inane BBC commentary and said,
"How are you, Grandpa Ted?"
She imagined him lying in bed in that horrible nursing home, living this unwelcome remnant of his life. Bertie wished she could rescue him, swoop in and carry him off, but he was too ill and frail now. Her grandfather had lived at Fanning Court for nearly 20 years. Then he fell and broke a leg, which led to pneumonia, which should have led to an easeful death.
"The old people's friend," Viola said wistfully.
But he pulled through it.
"He's immortal," Viola said.
He was a lesser person than before, near enough helpless, and he was discharged into the dubious arms of the nursing home, which was where, Bertie supposed, he would die.
"Every time I see him, I think it might be the last time," Viola said hopefully.
He deserved a better place to leave this life than Poplar Hill.
"And where is this mythical poplar and this mythical hill?"
Viola was always ranting, as if the problems with the place were a matter of semantics. Viola was furious at how much the nursing home cost. The sheltered flat was sold, but all the money was being swallowed up by the nursing home fees.
"But you have plenty of money," Bertie said. "That's not the point. He should care enough about me to leave me something. That's not the point. He should care enough about me to leave me something. A legacy. There'll be nothing left by the time he dies."
"Well, nothing left of him, at any rate," Bertie said. "And you don't really mean to be so horrible," she added.
"Yes, I do," Viola said.
"Are you watching the flotilla on television, Grandpa Ted?
The Jubilee?"
Oh, God, her intonation sounded like her mother's.
"Sonny sends his love," she reported,
and her grandfather seemed to chuckle, or perhaps he was choking, because he had always understood Sonny better than any of them. Grandpa Ted may have been pulsing slowly towards the end of his life, but he was still palpably himself, something her mother seemed incapable of understanding. Sonny hadn't actually sent his love, but he would have done if he'd known she was talking to their grandfather. Sonny loved his grandfather. His grandfather loved Sonny. It was the most complicated arrangement.
"I'm going to Singapore tomorrow."
Her mother's rather shrill tone suddenly replaced her grandfather's silence, and Bertie recoiled from the phone.
"Singapore? A literary festival."
Viola used to sound embarrassingly pleased with herself when she talked about the more glamorous end of publishing. "A meeting in London with a film producer. Lunch at the Ivy with my publishers. The main stage at Cheltenham." Now she just sounded oddly defeated.
"I'll be in London tonight," she said. "I could take you to dinner. At dinner."
"Sorry, I'm busy." It was the truth, but Bertie would have said it anyway. Her mother sounded disappointed, which was interesting, as for over 30 years it had been the other way round.
"Are you going to see Sonny?" she asked her.
"Sonny?
Your only son?" "Singapore isn't Bali. It's a completely different country,"
Viola said, although she sounded unsure. Geography never had been her strong point.
"It's a hop and a skip away, though. You'll be well over halfway there when you get to Singapore. It's not as if you have anything else to do."
"And you should," Bertie added. "And quickly, because you may not know this, but the universe has already started collapsing. There are signs everywhere. I have to go."
"No, you don't."
"No, I don't, but I am. Say goodbye to Grandpa Ted for me." The Queen had reached Tower Bridge. Bertie turned the television off, alert for signs of the universe collapsing. There was an old Aga in the kitchen that pumped out heat. She thought of it as akin to a big friendly animal. Next to the Aga was a small armchair covered in a crochet blanket, and on the blanket a large tabby cat was sound asleep. The stone flag floor was warmed by hand-hooked rugs. A Welsh dresser held blue and white crockery, and on the large scrubbed deal table was a little china jug of sweet peas and marigolds from the garden. Bertie was standing at the ancient Belfast sink, patiently drying pots and laying them on the wooden draining board. She could see the garden from the kitchen window. The garden was a little corner of Eden, the scarlet flowers of runner beans, the neat mounds of strawberry plants and tangled rows of peas. an apple tree next to the... A siren interrupted this delightful reverie. Bertie was on her way back from lunch at the Wolseley with a production company. On Piccadilly, she discovered there was a sense of occasion in the air, or threat. It was hard to tell the difference. Police and military everywhere and crowds corralled on the pavement. A motorcycle escort signalled importance. A huge car containing royalty swept past. The Bomber Memorial, someone explained when she asked. Of course. The Queen was dedicating the new Bomber Memorial today, midway between the Jubilee and the start of the Olympics, a patriotic summer of red, white and blue for London. Later, on television, because this was another second-hand spectacle, she watched the ceremony on the news, saw all the fragile old men struggling to hold back tears, and couldn't hold back her own, as each one reminded her of her grandfather and the mysterious past. Bertie waited patiently with the crowds on the pavement. Bomber Command had waited 70 years. She supposed she could wait a few minutes. A formation of Tornado fighter jets roared overhead, thrillingly noisy, and were followed by a lone Lancaster that dropped the contents of its bomb bay over London. Poppies bloomed in a stain of red on the blue and white summer sky. Bertie was on her way home from work when Viola phoned.
"We've been summoned," she said portentously.
"Summoned?"
"Asked to come, by the nursing home," Viola said.
She sounded excited.
She loved drama, as long as it didn't threaten her.
"Grandpa Ted,"
Bertie said, suddenly alert.
"What's happened?"
"Well,"
Viola said, as if about to embark on a thrilling narrative, when in fact all that had happened was that Teddy had fallen asleep yesterday evening and couldn't be woken this morning.
"They said to get there as soon as possible, but I won't be able to get a flight until the morning. It'll be late tomorrow night before I can get to York."
"I'll set off and drive there now," Bertie said.
It wasn't them who had been summoned, Bertie thought. It was her grandfather. The angels had finally called him in.
"They took their time about it," Viola said.
2012. The Last Flight. Dharma.
There is a Hindu legend that tells us that there was once a time when all men were gods, but they abused their divinity. Brahma, the god of creation, concluded that people had lost the right to their divinity and decided to take it away from them. Wanting to hide it somewhere where they wouldn't be able to find it, he called a council of all the gods to advise him. Some suggested that they bury it deep in the earth, others that they sink it in the ocean, others still suggested it be placed on top of the highest mountain. But Brahma said that mankind was ingenious and would dig down far into the earth, trawl the deepest oceans, and climb every mountain in an effort to find it again. The gods were on the point of giving up when Brahma said, "I know where we will hide man's divinity. We will hide it inside him. He will search the whole world, but never look inside and find what is already within."
Viola wasn't really listening. Sonny liked to finish his yoga sessions with what she thought of as a little sermon. Words of wisdom from the enlightened pulled from all over the place. Hinduism, Sufism, Buddhism, even Christianity. The Balinese themselves, she had learned, were Hindu. Viola had been under the misapprehension that they were Buddhists.
"We're all the Buddha," Sonny said.
"It sounds preachy in print," Viola wrote in an email to Bertie, "but actually it's sort of uplifting. He would have made rather a good vicar." Who was this new, docile version of her mother, Bertie wondered. Sonny taught at a place called The Bright Way in Ubud. To begin with, Viola had avoided the sessions at The Bright Way. She was staying at an outrageously expensive wellness retreat hotel a half-hour's drive away, where they had their own yoga teacher, and where the private, individual classes were held in something called the Yoga Bale, a pleasant, airy pavilion constructed from polished teak, situated amongst trees in which birds trilled and cackled in an exotic fashion, and insects droned or clacked like wind-up mechanical toys. At the Bright Way, on the other hand, classes took place in a huge upstairs room that was hot and stuffy, even with all the windows flung open in an effort to catch a breeze. It was quite basic, or the product of a simple ascetic, depending on your viewpoint, Viola's or that of the Bright Way's website. Despite the size of the room, it was always crowded, mostly with women, athletic young Australians and middle-aged Americans. Most of the latter seemed to be doing what Bertie called their eat-pray-love shit. Sunny qualified as a yoga teacher years ago in India, and he was currently teaching on Bali. He was, apparently, a respected teacher on the international circuit. He frequently travelled to America and Australia to hold retreats that were always booked up. Everyone was in retreat, it seemed to Viola. Sunny was all over the internet if you knew where to look, if you knew who to look for, because although you would have thought that Sun, or even Sunny, might be a good name for someone who did what he was doing, he was known to all and sundry as Ed. Son Edward Todd, he said reasonably to Viola. It's my name. And that was only a small part of his transformation. The physique of a dancer, the shaven head, the oriental tattoos, the wash of an Australian accent were all a complete surprise to her. A changeling, and women loved him. They were like groupies, especially the Eat, Pray, Love crowd. Viola hadn't seen Sunny for nearly 10 years, and in the interim he had turned into a complete human being. Perhaps the two things aren't unrelated, Bertie said. Thank you for this practice. Namaste, Sunny said, bowing with his hands in prayer. There were a lot of murmured thank yous and namastes in return. They took it so seriously. Sunny leapt up from his lotus pose with alarming fluidity. Viola struggled to her feet, not from a lotus pose, merely a stiff and uncomfortable cross-legged position that reminded her of school assemblies. Sunny lived in a village quite close to her outrageously expensive hotel, yet seemed to have no intention of inviting Viola into his home, so she decided, reluctantly, that the only way she was going to get to spend time with him was by coming along to his classes and putting up with the inane adoration of his other students, to which he appeared sublimely indifferent, not to mention the hideous physical challenges of the class. She had done yoga before, of course, who hadn't? But it had usually taken place in drafty church halls or community centres, and had involved not much more than a bit of cautious stretching, and then lying down and visualising yourself in a place where you felt safe and at peace. This was always a challenge for Viola, and while other people, women, always women, were lying on a tropical beach somewhere or in a deck chair in their garden, Viola's imagination was running around fretfully looking for something, anything, that it could recognise as peaceful and safe. When Sunny finished his Hindu homily and they'd all namaste'd each other to death, the American woman who had occupied the mat next to Viola, Shirley, with two E's, turned to her and said, Ed's a wonderful teacher, isn't he? The boy who couldn't be taught anything, Viola thought. I'm his mother, she said. How long since Viola had said those words? Not since Sunny was in school, probably. Oh, a sudden, horrible memory of the casualty department at St. James's Hospital in Leeds came back to her. Sunny had just started college, and she had thought it must be drugs when the hospital phoned her. But apparently he had been found wandering in the street with blood dripping from his arm from a botched attempt at cutting his wrist. I'm his mother, she had yelled at the doctor treating him when he told her that it was best that Sunny didn't see anyone just now. Why? She had asked him when she was finally allowed into his cubicle. Why did he do it? The usual inarticulate shrug. Don't know. When pressed,
Because my life's shit? Did he still have the scar? Was it hidden by the complicated dragon that curled up his arm? Shirley, with two E's, laughed and said, I don't think of him as having a mother. Everyone has a mother. Not God, Shirley said. Even God, Viola said. Perhaps that's where it had all started to go wrong. Of course, no one would know by observing them that they were mother and son. Sonny called her Viola, and she didn't really call him anything. He treated her exactly the same as he treated everyone else in the class, with a detached kind of concern.
Do you have arthritis in your knees?
No, she didn't, thank you very much.
Surprise?
She said, when she eventually tracked him down.
It is, he said.
They had hugged warily, as if one of them might have a knife. Only Bertie and Sonny knew where she was. She hadn't bothered to tell the staff at Poplar Hill that she was on a different continent from her ailing father. She was at the other end of the phone, if they needed to contact her. She had stepped out of her life. If she'd known how easy it was, she would have done it long ago. She had sent an email to her agent and asked her to tell people that she was having an operation. She was. She was having her mind removed, and to make her apologies all round. She didn't want people to think she had absconded, disappeared, like Agatha Christie. The last thing she wanted was people looking for her. No, that wasn't true. The last thing she wanted was people finding her. The incredibly expensive hotel where Viola was staying had been converted from an old estate and sat at the top of a gorge from where there were lovely views along the river a long way below. There were security guards and personal butlers, and nothing was any trouble at all. She had a villa, the largest, the most expensive, all to herself. It was far too big, it could have accommodated several families, but she liked the solitude. When she got up in the morning, she could make coffee in the high-end espresso machine in the living area. Surely everywhere was a living area. And drink it while she watched the mist rising from the valley below, and listened to the birds calling to each other across the forest. Then someone would bring her something delicious for breakfast, and she would go to the spa and be massaged, or walk down the ancient stone steps to the sacred river. She wasn't sure why it was sacred. Sonny said all rivers are sacred. Everything was sacred, apparently.
Even dog shit? Yes, even dog shit.
She was compiling a list of things that might not be sacred. Hiroshima, jihadist massacres, kittens in microwaves. Those are acts, Sonny said, not things. But weren't acts committed by people, and weren't people sacred, or was it just trees and rivers? In the afternoon she slept, an alarming amount, and then woke up and had the hotel car drive her to Ubud, where she joined Sonny's class. He didn't even save her a place on the mat-crowded floor, so that if she arrived late there was no room for her, and she had to sit in the little office and read the books they had in a small library, i.e. a shelf. All the books had some kind of spiritual slant, needless to say. There was a handwritten sign attached to the shelf that said, Please, dear friend, leave these books in the condition that you found them, which was ridiculous, as no book could ever be left in the condition that you found it in, because it was changed every time it was read by someone. The class, if there was space for her, lasted for 2 hours. It was designed with punishment in mind. And afterwards the driver would take her back to the hotel, and she would watch the family of monkeys that came out from the forest every evening to play on the old estate walls around her villa. She would eat dinner too, of course. The eat part was easy. The praying and loving were harder. Once or twice she had been to Sunny's early morning meditation class, which was less crowded but even more difficult.
Don't think, Viola,
Sonny said.
How could anyone not think? Don't not think, either. I think, therefore I am, Viola said,
clinging doggedly on to an outmoded Cartesian universe. If she stopped thinking,
she might cease to exist.
Just let go,
Sunny said.
Let go of what?
She had nothing to hold on to begin with. And then, the flowing river, the calling birds, the mechanical insects, the chattering monkeys, all finally did their job, and her mind stopped working, and it was the most unbelievable relief. In the car, on the way to Sunny's class, her phone surprised her by ringing. It was the nursing home. The end was nigh. She had been waiting for her father to die so her life could begin. But as we could all have told her, it doesn't work like that. She knew that anyway, really.
The Buddha asked a Shramana, how long is the human lifespan? He replied, a few days. The Buddha said, you have not yet understood the way.
He asked another Shramana, how long is the human lifespan?
The reply was, the space of a meal.
The Buddha said, you have not yet understood the way.
He asked another Shramana, how long is the human lifespan?
He replied, the length of a single breath.
The Buddha said, excellent, you have understood the way. The words flowed over Viola. She had no idea what they meant. She had taken Sunny's class, as usual. She saw no reason not to. It would be tomorrow morning before she would be able to get on a flight back to Britain. She waited until Sunny had namaste'd everyone, the Eat, Pray, Love Brigade behaving as if he was bestowing a blessing on them before they trooped reluctantly out into the heat and humidity of the early evening. Viola stayed.
Viola?
Sunny said, and smiled solicitously at her as if she were an invalid.
The nursing home called, she said. My father's dying.
Grandpa Ted?
Sunny's brow furrowed, and he bit his lip, and for a moment she saw the shade of a younger Sunny.
Are you going back?
Yes, although I expect Bertie will get there long before me.
Are you going to come?
No,
Sunny said. There were many things Viola could have said at this point. She had thought of all of them while gazing at the forest, the sacred river, the birds. I'm sorry, being foremost. But instead she told him about the dream.
And then you turned to me, and you were smiling, and you said, we did it, Mum. Everyone got on the train.
I don't think it was about the train.
No, Viola agreed. It was how I felt when you spoke to me.
Which was?
Overwhelmed by love.
For you.
Oh, Viola. At last.
Bertie had brought a copy of The Last Chronicle of Barset with her, and sat at Teddy's bedside reading to him. She knew it was one of his favourite books, and she supposed it didn't matter much whether or not he could understand the words, because it might be soothing for him to hear the familiar rhythms of Trollope's prose. He made a little sound, not speech, but something, as if he was confused. She put the book down on his bedspread and held one of his fragile, clawed hands in hers.
It's Bertie Moon here, Grandpa, she said.
The flesh on his hands was like melted tallow, and the veins were great blue ropes. His other hand was held up at a right angle, and he waved it around gently, as if he was asking to be excused. Which he was, she supposed. He was a baby once, she thought, new and perfect, cradled in his mother's arms. The mysterious Sylvie. Now he was a feathery husk, ready to blow away. His eyes were half open, milky like an old dog, and his mouth had grown beaky with the extremity of age, opening and closing, a fish out of water. Bertie could feel a continual tremor running through him, an electrical current, the faint buzz of life. Or death, perhaps. Energy was gathering around him. The air was static with it. Teddy was fighting F. Fox, trying to keep her flying straight and level. She wanted to give up. The bomb aimer, Clifford, appeared by his side and said the fire had prevented him from getting to the rear gunner. Teddy knew nothing about the boy except that he looked terrified out of his mind, and Teddy thought he had been brave to go and help the rear gunner, Charlie, who he also knew nothing about. The only thing Teddy could think at that moment was that those boys had to be saved. He told Clifford to jump, but he had lost his parachute, and Teddy said, "Take mine. Take it. Go on, jump." And Clifford hesitated, but obeyed his captain, and took the parachute and disappeared through the escape hatch. He was St. George, and England was his Cleolinda, but the dragon was overpowering him, burning him up with its fiery breath. There was a curtain of flames behind him. He could feel them beginning to scorch his seat. The intercom was no longer working, and he didn't know if the rear gunner had got out or not, so he carried on wrestling with F. Fox. The room was lit by just one dim lamp. It was nearly midnight, and the nursing home had been overcome by sleep, disturbed only by the occasional shriek of terror that sounded like a small animal being attacked. Her grandfather was dying of old age, Bertie thought, worn out. Not cancer, or a heart attack, or an accident, or a catastrophe. Old age seemed like a hard way to go. There were long gaps between each rasping breath now. Sometimes he seemed to panic and say something, and Bertie squeezed his hand and stroked his cheek, and murmured to him about the bluebell woods she had never seen, and the people she had never met who would be waiting for him. Hugh and Sylvie, Nancy and Ursula. Of the dogs, of the long sunny days. Was that where he was bound? To long sunlit days at Fox Corner? Or eternal darkness? Or just nothing? For even darkness had a quality to it, whereas nothing was truly nothing. Were Spencer's bright squadrons of angels waiting to welcome him? Were all the mysteries about to be revealed? They were questions that no one had ever answered, and no one ever would. She fed him scraps from her rag bag, because words were all that were left now. Perhaps he could use them to pay the ferryman. Much have I travelled in the realms of gold. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. Full fathom five thy father lies. Little lamb, who made thee? Though worlds of wanwood leaf-meal lie, on that best portion of a good man's life, his little nameless unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Father and father, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire. The air rippled and shimmered. Time narrowed to a pinpoint. It was about to happen. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. Moments left, Teddy thought. A handful of heartbeats. That was what life was. A heartbeat followed by a heartbeat. A breath followed by a breath. One moment followed by another moment, and then there was a last moment. Life was as fragile as a bird's heartbeat, fleeting as the bluebells in the wood. It didn't matter, he realized. He didn't mind. He was going where millions had gone before, and where millions would follow after. He shared his fate with the many. And now, this moment was infinite. He was part of the infinite. The tree and the rock and the water. The rising of the sun and the running of the deer. Now. The trumpets sound the end of the revels. The baseless fabric begins to disintegrate. The stuff that dreams are made of starts to rend and tear, and the walls of a cloud-capped tower tremble. Little showers of dust begin to fall. Birds rise in the air and fly away. Sonny is sitting on the veranda of the room he rents, meditating in the dark before dawn. He is moving out soon. His Australian girlfriend, also a yoga teacher, is 6 months pregnant and has already gone back to Sydney. Sonny is going to join her there in a few weeks. He's going to accompany Viola to the airport later this morning and see her on the plane, and before he says goodbye to her, he will give her the gift of this knowledge to take home with her. His other gift to her will be the little silver hair that he has kept all these years, against the odds.
For luck. For protection.
His Australian girlfriend is the Buddha. She is carrying the Buddha inside her. He takes in a sudden breath as if he has been asleep and has woken suddenly. An alarming crack appears in the gorgeous palace. The first wall shivers and crumbles. The second wall buckles and falls. Stones tumble to the ground. Viola is drinking her coffee, waiting for the dawn, waiting for the mist to lift from the river and the birds to start calling. She's thinking about her mother. She's thinking about her children. She's thinking about her father. She is overcome by the pain of love. The birds commence their dawn chorus. Something is happening. Something is changing. For a moment she is gripped by panic. Don't be afraid, she thinks. And she isn't. The third wall comes down with a great crash, sending up a cloud of dust and debris. Bertie is holding her grandfather's hand, willing him to feel her love. Because isn't that what everyone would want to be the last thing that they feel? She leans over and kisses his hollow cheek. Something tremendous is happening, something catastrophic. She is going to be a witness of it. Time starts to tilt. Now, she thinks. The fourth wall of the solemn temple falls as quietly as feathers. He could no longer fight F. Fox. The aircraft was mortally wounded. A bird shot out of the air. Ah, bright wings. He heard the words quite clearly, as if someone in the cockpit had spoken them. He had made it to the coast. Beneath him the moon glinted off the North Sea like a thousand diamonds. He was reconciled to this moment, to this now. The noise in the aircraft had ceased. The heat from the flames had disappeared. There was just a beautiful, unearthly silence. He thought of the wood and the bluebells, the owl and the fox, a Hornby train trundling around his bedroom floor, the smell of a cake baking in the oven, the skylark ascending on his thread of song. F. Fox fell with Teddy still inside her. A blaze of light in the dark, a bright star, an exaltation, until her fires were finally quenched by the waves. It was over. Teddy sank to the silent seabed and joined all the tarnished treasure that lay there unseen, 40 fathoms deep. He was lost forever. Only a small silver hair to keep him company in the dark. And with a massive roar, the fifth wall comes down, and the house of fiction falls, taking Viola and Sonny and Bertie with it. They melt into the thin air and disappear. Poof! The books that Viola wrote vanish from bookshelves as if by magic. Dominic Villers marries a girl who wears pearls and a twin set and drinks himself to death. Nancy marries a barrister in 1950 and has 2 sons. During a routine examination, her brain cancer is discovered and successfully removed. Her mind is less keen, her intelligence less bright, but she is still Nancy. A man, a doctor, standing on Westminster Bridge, turns away after the Jubilee barge Gloriana has passed beneath the bridge. For a moment, he thinks someone is standing beside him, but there is no one there, only a fluctuation in the air.
He feels as if he has just lost something, but can't imagine what it might be. An Australian yoga teacher on Bali worries that she will never find someone to love, never have a child. An old woman called Agnes dies in Poplar Hill nursing home, dreaming of escape. Sylvie overdoses on sleeping tablets on VE Day, unable to come to terms with a future that doesn't contain Teddy, her best boy. Across the world, millions of lives are altered by the absence of the dead. But three members of Teddy's last crew, Clifford the bomb aimer, Fraser the injured pilot, and Charlie, the tail-end Charlie, all bail out successfully from F. Fox and see out the rest of the war in a POW camp. On their return, they all marry and have children, fractals of the future. 55,573 dead from Bomber Command. 7 million German dead, including the 500,000 killed by the Allied bombing campaign. The 60 million dead overall of the Second World War, including 11 million murdered in the Holocaust. The 16 million of the First World War, over 4 million in Vietnam, 40 million to the Mongol conquests, 3.5 million to the Hundred Years' War. The fall of Rome took 7 million. The Napoleonic Wars took 4 million. 20 million to the Taiping Rebellion. And so on, and so on, and so on. All the way back to the garden when Cain killed Abel. All the birds who were never born. All the songs that were never sung. And so can only exist in the imagination. And this one is Teddy's. 1947. Daughters of Elysium. The hawthorn in the lane was just coming into blossom, and Ursula said,
"Oh, look, the hawthorn's flowering. Teddy would have loved to see that."
"Oh, don't," Nancy said, the tears starting. "I can't believe he's gone from this world forever."
They walked arm in arm, Lucky running backwards and forwards, excited to be in the lively warm air.
"I wish we had a grave to visit," Nancy said.
"I'm glad we don't," Ursula said. "Now we can imagine him as free as the air." "I can only imagine him at the bottom of the North Sea, cold and lonely. Of his bones are coral made," Ursula said. A tremulous, "Oh," from Nancy. "Those are pearls that were his eyes."
"Stop, do stop, please."
"Sorry. Do you want to walk across the meadow?"
"Look,"
Nancy exclaimed,
letting go of Ursula's arm and pointing towards the sky.
"There, a lark, a skylark. Listen,"
she added in a thrilled whisper, as though she might disturb the bird.
"Beautiful,"
Ursula murmured.
Enthralled to the skylark, they watched as it soared, flying further and further away, until it was no more than a speck in the blue sky, and then it was just the memory of the speck. Nancy sighed.
"Sometimes I wonder," she said, "about reincarnation. I know it's absurd, but wouldn't it be wonderful if Teddy came back as something else? As that skylark, say. I mean, we don't know, do we? That could have been Teddy saluting us, letting us know that he's all right, that he still is in some way. Do you believe in reincarnation?"
"No," Ursula said. "I believe we have just one life. And I believe that Teddy lived his perfectly.
And when all else is gone, art remains. Even Augustus." The Adventures of Augustus. The Awful Consequences.
"Isn't that Augustus?" Miss Slee whispered in Mr. Swift's ear. Quite a loud whisper, the kind that makes people in surrounding seats turn and look at you with interest. Mr. Swift's features were impassive, although he couldn't quite suppress a slight shudder at the spectacle before him. Miss Slee leaned further forward in her seat to catch Mrs. Swift's attention. "That is Augustus, isn't it?" she persisted, in an even louder whisper. "Your son," she added. It didn't really qualify any longer as a whisper, more of a shout. Mrs. Swift's expression remained inscrutable. The rest of the audience were as transfixed as Augustus's parents by the scene unfolding before them on the stage of the village hall. England through the ages had reached the Armada, and Elizabeth I was giving her rousing speech to the troops at Tilbury. Gloriana had commandeered Boadicea's chariot, a makeshift sort of affair, and was brandishing a trident that had been borrowed from Britannia. These two noble emblems of womanhood, played by Augustus's sister Phyllis and Lady Lamington from the hall, had not volunteered their possessions, and were standing at either side of the stage, glowering at Gloriana. The rest of the pageant players were gamely carrying on, despite the fact that half the scenery had collapsed, and several dogs were wandering aimlessly around on the stage. The vicar, sitting on the other side of Mrs. Swift, said to her, "But I thought Mrs. Brewster had taken on the role of Queen Elizabeth. Who is that on stage?" Gloriana's red wig had slipped down to one side, and having no proper costume, she had wrapped herself in a Roman centurion's cloak, again an item not voluntarily relinquished by said centurion. Her surprisingly grabby knees were visible beneath the cloak, and there was what looked to all intents and purposes to be a catapult in her pocket.
"You're doing jolly well, you lot!"
this dishevelled Gloriana yelled in a rather unqueenly way. "Killing all these spaniels and stuff!" "Spaniards!" Mrs. Garrett could be heard hissing from the side of the stage. Gloriana brandished Britannia's trident high and shouted, "Now let's go and kill the rest of them!" A marauding horde of children poured onto the stage, roaring and shouting and in some cases squeaking. The dogs barked excitedly at the sight of them. Some, nay many, of those children had previously been of good character, but now seemed to have come under the hypnotic spell of Gloriana, as apparently had many members of the audience, who were viewing her with open-mouthed horror. "Are the children supposed to be the Spaniards?" the vicar asked Mrs. Swift. "Invading hordes," he said, consulting the program notes. "I'm not sure I know who anyone is supposed to be any more," Mrs. Swift said, distracted by the hideous sight of the red wig slipping further down her son's face. "Are they the same children?" the vicar puzzled, "who were also the Saxons and the Vikings and the Normans? It's hard to tell now that they're all covered in green paint. What do you suppose that represents? England's green and pleasant land?" "I doubt it," Mrs. Swift said, and gave a little cry of alarm, as Boadicea's chariot, not robust to begin with, suddenly collapsed, and Gloriana toppled ingloriously to the stage, taking the remaining scenery with her. A small West Highland terrier ran on stage and with excellent timing snatched the red wig in its mouth and ran off with it, accompanied by some off-stage shrieking. "That is Augustus," Miss Slee said. "I have never seen that boy in my life before," Mr. Swift said resolutely. "Neither have I," Mrs. Swift said. In retrospect, Mr. Swift said gloomily, you could see that it was bound to end in disaster. "And it all started so well," Mrs. Swift said. "It always does," Mr. Swift said. The whole village had been in a state of great excitement. It had been discovered by Mr. Robinson, who ran the local history society, that the village was much older than anyone had thought, the proof coming from the remains of a Roman villa that had been unearthed in a field on the outskirts of the village. "Evidence of early occupation by our Roman conquerors," Mr. Robinson said. "A villa," Augustus reported back to his little gang of pals. His cohorts, Norman, George, and Roderick, had recently decided to give themselves a name. They had considered and rejected the pirates, the outlaws, and the robbers,
and after much discussion, endless, some might have said, and one or two mild scuffles,